This is our only experience, and I hope while you unfold your story, John, that I get an answer to some of the questions which were left answered before I left the civil service.
John Burton, thank you very much.
Well, the topic I've been assigned is the topic of trade union power, and I want to discuss the connection between trade union power, violence, and the state, and the connection between unionism and the free market. My ideas about this have been largely induced by the experience of the Anglo-Saxon countries, America, Britain, Canada, not Australia, about which I know very little, and some study of France and West Germany, but of course any of you from other countries might like to fill in with details about whether or not country experiences conform to what I'm saying or whether they point in a different direction. Well, I'm going to start off by arguing a very hard-line statement, and that is this, that at least in the countries that I've mainly been concerned to analyze, say America, Britain, Canada, trade unions are above the law in at least two ways, and possibly three ways. And it is in fact union monopoly power, and indeed the power of trade unions to coerce the rest of society, which they do in many instances. Trade union power to monopolize and to coerce rests upon these legal privileges. Firstly, trade unions are above the law in a de jure sense. In some countries, as in France and West Germany, that arises because they are granted positive rights which do not obtain to other legal individuals in that society. They are given certain positive rights. In Britain and America, there is a different legal tradition. Trade unions are above the law in a de jure sense because they are given immunities from the law which apply to all other individuals and legal entities in the society. As examples of that, in Britain, trade unions cannot be sued for any damage they cause to other individuals so long as they say they are in furtherance of a trade dispute. There are some qualifications to that under the 1980 and 1982 Employment Acts, but generally they cannot be sued for damages caused in furtherance of a trade dispute. And historically, the definition of a trade dispute has been so wide that it could include virtually anything. So long as the trade union said it was a trade dispute, then it was a trade dispute. Now, secondly, in most countries, certainly in America, Britain, and Canada, trade unions are above the law in a de facto sense. That is, even where it is the case that laws which apply to other legal individuals are also supposed to apply to trade unions, in practice these laws are not applied. And a classic number of glaring examples of that are going on, for example, in Britain right at this very moment. Let me give you one example, one of probably about 500 breaches of the situation whereby trade unions are de facto above the law in the current NUM, National Union of Miners, dispute. On August the 12th, just a few days ago, the Home Secretary, Mr. Leon Britton, stated publicly that those who organize mass picketing are personally responsible for the violence that they have caused. And he's talking, of course, about the organization of, not mass pickets, we're talking about the organization of armed quasi-military forces of up to 20,000 people surrounding installations. We're talking about people using battering rams, people using arson in a systematic fashion, causing millions of pounds of damage. We're talking about people who are surrounding literally thousands of people's homes to try and intimidate them to stop working. He's saying that those who organise this mass picketing and things like it are personally responsible for the violence. Now, let me point out that the Home Secretary in this country is the person responsible for the enforcement of law and order. And we have an Act of Parliament called the Criminal Law Act of 1977, which says that anyone who organises violence or conspires to organise violence for whatever purpose is in very serious breach of the criminal law. We're talking about one of the most serious felonies that exist. Now, I would like to know why the Home Secretary has not talked to the Attorney General of this country, if his opinion is that the people who are organising this violence, who, and we know very well who they are, if he has not talked to the Attorney General and said, well, look, why don't we just enforce the criminal law of conspiracy that obtains in this country? Now, exactly the same sort of situation whereby trade unions are treated as being de facto above the law also occurs and has occurred numerous times in both America and Britain. Now, a third way in which some trade unions are above the law is where we have trade unions in the public sector, because there they may draw upon the coercive power of the state to further entrench their monopoly. If we take coal mining in Britain, for example, we have here an industry in which competitive entry to the industry is prohibited by statute law. It is against the law to compete with the state monopoly. Secondly, taxpayers, whether they like it or not, are yearly forced to pay the subsidies to cover the losses of the industry, which have been mounting to over £1 billion per annum for the last couple of years. And thirdly, although this has been covered up by successive governments of every political colour over the past 20 years, another nationalised industry, the Central Electricity Generating Board, has been year after year pressurised and forced by the government to buy large quantities of British coal at a price and at a quantity that they do not want. It's possible to, for instance, buy deep mine coal from Australia at £17 a tonne. It's possible to buy deep mine coal from the eastern United States for from £22 to £25 a tonne. The average price at which the Central Electricity Generating Board in this country is forced to buy British coal is £45 to £46 a tonne. So what I'm trying to point out is that the monopoly and coercive power of the National Union of Mine Workers in this country rests not only on the fact that it has immunities under law, it doesn't simply rest on the fact that de facto it's above the law. It rests upon the coercive power of the state to entrench the monopoly in this industry and therefore of the organised group that is working within it. Now, the question, it seems to me, is how long societies can survive if the state creates within its own borders institutions which have the powers of the state to coerce. That is essentially the question that is being faced in Britain right at this moment. Mr. Arthur Scargill of the National Union of Mine Workers has openly said ever since 1975 that he considers his main goal to bring down the government, if it is a Conservative government, and if it is a Labour government, he believes that although the Labour government could be useful for a period of time, ultimately that would have to be swept away and replaced by a communist government. And he has a private army, variously estimated of between 4,000 and 5,000 people, who are willing to use quasi-military tactics to aid him in that goal. And as I've said earlier, there are various legal and de facto immunities which also help the organisation of such a private army. Now, the big question is whether or not a a stable society can survive if the state gives away its monopoly of coercion to other institutions which then have much the same power to coerce, and what will happen under that situation. And briefly, just to throw that question open, I'll just try to talk for another quarter of an hour if I may, and then throw it open to questions. That question was explored many years ago by the great classical liberal economist Henry C. Simons, who was, in case you don't know, Milton Friedman's mentor and tutor at the University of Chicago, and who wrote a very great essay, one of the classic essays of classical liberalism of this century, entitled Some Reflections Upon Syndicalism, which was published in 1944. I should tell you, by the way, that Simons was extremely gloomy about the future outlook. I'll be running through his thesis in a few minutes, but in fact he was so personally gloomy that he in fact committed suicide. I don't think we need to go that far this afternoon. but clearly there are very profound questions here about the survival of a free society when private armies can be organized and not even the so-called monopoly of violence of the state seem to be able to contain this situation. Well, what was Simon's view? Let me just briefly look at that. Well, Simons argued that once a trade union movement was fully matured and had the sort of immunities which apply, let us say, in America and Britain, then it must bring about automatically the collapse of both the market order and democracy. And he argued that in the following way. He argued that there are two main forms of economic power that a trade union wields. Firstly, there is strike threat power. And secondly, there is monopoly power. Now, these are related and reinforcing dimensions of trade union power, but you can distinguish them. Strike threat power is the ability to disrupt the plans of others in the short run, whereas monopoly power is the ability to work through the market by restricting supply. You gradually manage to push up the price. So if you like, strike threat power works by disrupting the market, and monopoly power works by a slow restriction or strangulation of supply, which means that the price of the monopolized good or service goes above its market level. Now, Henry Simons was arguing that the full utilization of both forms of these sorts of trade union economic powers would ultimately bring about the collapse of the market order, and thereby, so doing, it would bring about the collapse of democracy. Why? Well, firstly, if you look at strike threat power, he argued that the extensive utilization of strike threat power would be incompatible with the sustenance of an intricate division of labor. As he put it himself, in an economy of an intricate division of labor, every large organized group is in a position at any time to disrupt or stop the whole flow of social income, and the system must soon break down if groups persist in exercising that power, or if they must be continuously be bribed to forego its disastrous exercise. So in a highly developed economy in which there are many dimensions of specialization, anyone can turn off the tap if you've got a large enough organized group. And if everyone tries to do that, it means, of course, you have to ultimately forego the division of labor. And we're, if you like, bombed back to the Stone Age by the picket line. Now, Simons also argued that the exercise of union monopoly power would reinforce and add to those problems, because he argued that the increasing strangulation of successive industries by trade union monopolies would restrict economic opportunities so greatly, especially for the less skilled groups in society, that it would mean that very large numbers of people were, if you like, without a job and would not be able to get into the effective labour market which had been monopolised by the trade unions. So both through the exercise of widespread disruption and the gradual extermination of industries, trade unions would wreak tremendous economic chaos in the market order. So, he was arguing that organized economic warfare conducted by trade unions would destroy the market economy, and he argued furthermore to that that the destruction of the market order would bring down democracy in its wake. The reason is that he says that the problem lies in turning back the clock once you've got fully developed trade unionism. The problem is, he says, that majoritarian governments seem to be powerless to enforce the rule of law on mass minorities, even if they have the electoral majority behind them. Now, you might ask yourself the question about Britain at this very moment. It does seem to be the case that the government and the legal authorities seem to be unable to enforce the law of the land upon this particular mass minority, even though they have the electoral majority behind them, as I think they do. Now, the problem points out, Simons points out, is that if democratic governments are unable to restore the rule of law in the face of trade union power, then eventually it will be democracy that goes as well. He put it himself in the following way. Here possibly is an awful dilemma. Democracy cannot live with tight occupational monopolies, and it cannot destroy them once they attain great power without destroying itself in the process. So according to the Simons theorem, fully developed trade unionism, fully matured with the sort of legal immunities or rights that we see in Western countries, means the collapse of the market order, which means the end of democracy, and its replacement by a stronger form of government that would have the power to repress the powers of mass minorities. That's the Simons thesis. Let me just give you a few views upon that. I've argued that in a number of publications that Simons was right to worry about these questions, but he was probably wrong about some of the elements of his scenario, about the nature of the tension between unionism and democracy and the market. Let me just point out some of the differences, or some of the points I'd make about that. Firstly, Henry Simons assumed that by and large, all trade unions would be run as monopolistic institutions. That is, they would be largely run in the interests of their current members, and therefore they would adopt restrictive attitudes. They would want to keep down membership in order to maximize their monopoly rent, just like any good monopolist. I would say myself that that's not a very good model of the trade union. It applies to certain sorts of craft unions, which are fairly small in number and have a fairly identifiable skill which to monopolize. What his model does not seem to encompass is the behavior of very large modern mass trade unions, which have very large numbers of members, often ranging up to the 2 million mark in the case of the Teamsters or the Transport and General Workers Union in this country. Now, I would argue about that sort of very large trade union. It is usually the case that the members are completely unable to police the behavior of their elected leaders, and they tend not to behave as monopolistic institutions. Rather, they behave as institutions whereby the leaders have tremendous executive discretion to pursue their own preferences. Now, that is inherent in the nature of the trade union as an economic institution. It is an institution where it is very difficult for the membership to police the behaviour of the leadership. The reason is this. Firstly, there is no market in the ownership rights in trade unions. In the case of a corporation, which is also a voting institution, like a trade union, voting rights can be bought and sold. And if the stockholders are convinced that the executives are not following their own interests, they can sell their voting rights. Moreover, other individuals can acquire and aggregate through the market those voting rights, put together enough of those voting rights to launch a takeover bid, sack the incumbent leadership, install your own management, and turn the corporation round back to profitability. Now, that's not possible in the case of trade unions because there is simply no market in the ownership rights of trade unions. Secondly, typically, in many cases, trade union leaders are elected for life, or the voting system within the trade union is so weak that it's impossible to challenge an incumbent leader.